Hey, what's up, everybody? My name is Seth Perler with the Executive Function Online Summit, TFOS 2019. I'm super excited to be here with Debbie Reber. Many of you might know Debbie Reber from the Tilt Parenting podcast. Debbie's an author. She runs my favorite parenting podcast, and she's done amazing work. I love how she shows up in the world. And some of you may know the story that a big reason that this summit exists is because of Debbie. Sorry to put you on the spot, but I had this idea for some time, but at some point a few months ago, Debbie said, you want me to put some emails out to so-and-so and so-and-so, and before I knew it, I had a handful of people who were ready to rock and roll, and I said, I guess this thing is a reality, and now there are 7 billion moving pieces that we are getting together. But thank you, Debbie, for that. So anyhow, Debbie Reber really is a neat person and who I have a heck of a lot of respect for. And today she's going to talk to us about executive function and parenting and homeschooling and how it plays into it. So Debbie, hi.
Hi, I'm so happy that you're making this summit happen and that I played a little part in it.
A big part in it. Big. It's pretty much your fault. And that sounds like a negative word. It's a good anyhow, thing. Thank you. So let's start off, Debbie, before we get into the professional stuff. Tell us about who you are. Debbie and I just met recently. We've known each other for, it feels like years, but pretty well, and have really done a lot of communication professionally and stuff. And we finally just met a couple months ago in Oregon. And then last week in New York. I think that's what's the, oh no, I was in New Jersey. It's hard to tell. So Debbie, who are you personally outside of work?
Oh, wow. I'm the mom of a almost 15-year-old, twice exceptional, awesome human named Asher. I am someone who, recently moved back to the U.S. from the Netherlands, where we lived for 6 years, where I was homeschooling my son. And so I'm kind of an expat and trying to figure out rhythm in our new life. Personal things, I'm really into running, and I hope to be that old lady running when I'm 80. That's like winning her age group and 5Ks and things, but that's a big part of my life. And yeah, serial entrepreneur, serial author, and really good executive functioning skills. And and that's a big part. Like, I'm a planner, an organizer, and a doer.
Awesome. And let's see, professionally, what do you like to talk about? Who are you?
Yeah, so professionally, it's also always hard to kind of figure out how to describe myself.
You wear a lot of hats.
Yeah, I've been writing for 20 years. I used to write books for teenage girls, kind of self-help books for teenagers, and I'm still writing, but my most recent book was for parents like me. I am a podcaster, which has been now 3.5 years. I've been doing that, which I love. And the creator of Tilt Parenting, which started off as kind of a revolution, I called it, to try to change the parenting paradigm for how neurologically atypical kids are experience the world and how their families experience the world. And that has grown into a community and a bigger movement, which has been really exciting. So, and before that, I used to work in kids TV, and I still have little bits and pieces of me, like dabbling in all these other areas and working with some content creators and in kids programming.
So for the parent that's watching that's never heard the word did you say neurodiverse?
Yeah, or neurologically atypical, yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so, and I actually have used the term differently wired. That was a word that wasn't really being used to describe these kids. And so it's been really exciting to see that become very popular since I launched Tilt Parenting. But I use that to describe anyone who has any sort of learning difference, neurological difference, anyone who would be in some way considered not normal, which is most of us really. But it includes everything from giftedness to, you know, learning differences like dyslexia, dysgraphia, processing speed, sensory processing issues, twice exceptionality, ADHD, autism spectrum, anxiety. So when I created Tilt Parenting, you know, there are so many parents like me who have kids that either have multiple things going on, and it's often unclear like what's what. There's a lot of overlap and misdiagnosis. And I also felt that, you know, these labels were dividing us into little buckets and keeping us small and not letting us recognize our power in numbers. And so when I launched Tilled Parenting, I wanted it to be inclusive of anyone who's moving through the world differently, because when you start looking at, you know, the numbers, they, you know, the official numbers like 1 in 5, but it's way more than that of kids who are in some way neurodivergent. And so when we look at those numbers, we can't be ignored. So I think that's an important part of the movement, is to be more inclusive and recognize all these different ways and start to demand that kids like ours are getting their needs met and that they are fully embraced in schools and in society.
And obviously, if you want to make sure that more kids are included and getting their needs met, then there's a problem. How do you define the problem of them not getting their needs met? What does that look like? And what does that look like for the parent who's watching right now and there's no diagnosis or label at all, but they're like, I'm pretty sure my kid is differently wired. I just don't even know where to start with a label or anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest problem is that for most of these kids, and they're often have invisible differences, so it's not that evident, is that it shows up typically, especially when they're younger, as behavioral challenges. And that is the biggest struggle for most parents, is when you start getting feedback from preschool teachers or elementary school teachers that, you know, Johnny's not sitting still in song circle, or, you know, they're not doing their work, or they're being disruptive, or whatever it is. And the challenge there is that we focus just on the behavior instead of recognizing that what is going on with that child is a reaction to their needs, their emotional, their regulation needs not being met. And so we instantly go into fix-it mode to try to get their behavior on track, to get them to be more compliant so they fit into the system that was never designed for them. And then we never really let the child kind of recognize who they are. And they often start to identify as the bad kid. They start to feel badly about themselves. Parents start to live in secrecy, concern about stigma. And it just creates this whole snowball effect that is so unhealthy for our families. It hurts relationships. It really hurts these kids who kind of internalize this message that they're broken. And, you know, so that's a big part of why I created Tilt, was just to help parents know that actually your child isn't an aberration. You know, I was told when Asher was in kindergarten that he was going to a private school for gifted kids. And this head of school, who'd been there for 30 years, told me that my child was the most intense child she'd ever met in her life. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, you know, but I think a lot of parents like me feel singled out like that. We feel like our kid is the one that is just so unusual, and they're not. It's a child whose needs aren't being met. And that's what we have to fix.
So that one of the, Debbie knows that one of the things that I want to do is start a podcast 3, but one of them that's really that where people can tell their stories, because one of the problems that I've seen being in education for over 20 years is that I would hear parents privately tell me the same stories over and over, but they're not sharing it necessarily with each other. I would also hear teachers, even administrators or other school personnel, tell me the same stories over and over, but they're not bringing those things up at staff meetings. They're things that they say in private. And they're the same stories about dysfunction and struggles. And I think that a lot of the parents feel so alone, like they're the only one. And it is so clear, you and I know, because we are in the trenches and hear this all the time, that they are not alone. You said at least 1 in 5 probably is neurodiverse. And do you think 1 in 5 parents is struggling with this? And do you think other parents are struggling with it who don't even know that it's going on?
Yeah, you know, when I was last summer, I had a chance to travel around the U.S. and meet with parent groups, and I went to this one event in Pennsylvania, and it was maybe 35 people were there. And afterwards, these five women came up to me and were so excited. And they shared with me that they had seen each other at school pickups or gymnastics or, you know, just in the community for years. So they kind of knew them by sight, and they had no idea that the others were raising atypical kids. And they were so excited to find each other, and they formed a little group, and they were going to start meeting regularly. But I think that's the norm, that we don't know how to identify, and people are afraid to talk about things. And it's this isolating reality. And many of us just, we can really sink to a deep, dark place. You know, we can just start awfulizing that our child has no future. Everything is always going to be hard. It's just a really tough spot to be in. And when you feel that way, you are certainly not going to be able to show up for your child in the way that they need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm just processing what you just said, because there's so much to it. Yeah, I ask myself questions like why is there so much shame? Like, parents are so, and I have theories, but I think that parents are so afraid to find out, oh my God, I'm a bad parent. Oh my God, I'm doing it wrong. And they're so, and I do think we need to be having the conversations, but there's stuff around it. And that's why it's so good. And that's why, like, on my stuff, I'll often talk a lot, very personally, about some of my stuff. I know you do as well. But I think it's so important to normalize the right things in our culture. And part of it is that, like you said, these kids are not broken. You as the parent are not broken. We are where we are. If we go down the path of, like, educating ourselves and learning as much as we can, then we can live in solution rather than being stuck in the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talk a lot about disruptors, you know, and this idea that we value disruptors when they're, you know, creating innovative technology and working for startups. Like, we want people to disrupt industries, but our kids are disruptors. You know, those same people who are disruptors of industries were probably the disruptive kids. Right. And so we need to recognize that, or we'll lose that too. We'll lose the gifts that these kids have. So yeah, I could go on for hours and hours about that, but it's really, there's so much at stake here, and it's just such important work to be done. And no child should feel like they're broken when they have such incredible gifts to share.
So I have two or three more quick questions before we get into, I think I lost you, your video. Let me know if you can hear me.
I don't know what happened. Maybe I got too excited and I pushed.
So I have two or three more quick questions before we dive deeper into the topic for the day. But you chose, and I actually don't know this, but you chose to call the podcast Tilt, and it's T-I-L-T with all capitals except for the I. How'd you come up with Tilt?
I wish I had some great story.
Okay.
I don't. Although, here's the quick story. When we moved abroad, which was in 2013, we knew everything was about to change. And we went to the Jersey Shore, our family. And my son and I rode on the Tilt-A-Whirl, you know, that ride that kind of whips you around unexpectedly. It's awesome. It's like the only ride that my son will go on. Yeah. Okay. And so my husband took a picture of Asher and I when we were going around a whip, and we're like holding on, and we've got these huge grins on our faces. So I love that picture because it captured so much of what I felt like our life was like. You know, we didn't know when the next turn was going to whip us around. You know, we had to hold on for dear life, but we could find fun and joy in it. Like, just hold on for the ride. And that really encapsulated our huge leap of faith to move abroad, to start homeschooling, to just shake everything up. So I started a blog back then called Tilt a World. And that's kind of the origins of it. I just wanted to share our story. And then when I started developing what became Tilt Parenting, I was, you know, I had lists and lists of names, and my son was vetting them, and most of them he was like, nope, nope, negative connotation, nope, nope, nope. And I was like, what about tilt? And it's just such a strong word. And then there's so many ways to look at like tilting our perspective, and we need to kind of tilt our reality and shift our experience to really serve these kids. So it just kind of worked. And then Asher gave me the sign off. So.
Okay. And then also in your book, that's right. It has, what's your tilt on this and that? And you have
18
different tilts.
Yeah.
I that's a great connotation too. Your perspective.
Yeah.
On something. Okay, cool. And then my last question as an intro wise is, how do you define executive function in one sentence or a phrase or whatever, and then unpack that for us a little bit?
I've always thought of executive function as the kind of command central of the brain. That was how it was described to me by someone who had worked with Asher many years ago. So kind of command central is the short answer. And then, you know, I, in many ways, my longer definition is related to what I, you know, what are my son's executive functioning challenges. But I think of it as, you know, all those things you need to do to be, to kind of live your life, to be able to, you know, pay your bills on time and plan for things and show up to work on time and have a goal and know how to break it down and reach that goal. To get started on something that seems daunting. So, you know, I know that it's like planning and organizing and task initiation and emotional regulation. Like I know what those things are, but you know, from like a technical point of view, but for me, it's really all those skills that you need to be able to achieve the things you want to achieve, that you have the capability to have something you want to do and know how to break it down, how to set up yourself for success to be able to get there.
And as a parent, what are your concerns, like a homeschooling parent or not, but what are your concerns about your child if they don't have good enough executive function? What yours personally?
Yeah. I mean, of course, it's always, what is this going to look like down the road? I think, you know, like many parents, I tend to kind of go to, you know, will this child ever be able to launch, live independently, hold down a job, finish college? Like when you have a child that has so much potential, that feels like a huge responsibility and a gift, right? And we already know that many gifted kids don't ever reach their potential. That's statistically proven, that being gifted isn't a recipe for a happy, fulfilled adulthood. But when you have a child who has so much potential, it feels like we can see what's possible. And then we have all these things that feel overwhelming and are all barriers to reaching that potential. And I always kind of would go to the future. Like what is this really going to look like? And because our kids are often on lagging timelines, you know, we really can kind of, or I can definitely get stuck in that space of, this is never going to come together. You know, this is always going to be hard and these things are always going to be barriers. And I know that's not true, but it takes a long time.
I think it's important to define what you mean by a lagging timeline, because I think a lot of people watching who are not familiar with your work or a lot of this stuff, what do you mean by lagging timeline?
Well, you know, especially for gifted kids or 2E kids, but kids with ADHD, we know too, which my son has, they're often just socially, emotionally, maybe far, you know, below, even if cognitively they're ahead of their peers, they might be. But so where we see their same age peers being able to do certain things like get their lunch ready for school or, you know, remember to turn in their homework every day or whatever it is, that isn't something that maybe our kid is doing at the same time as their peers are. And, you know, we can make that mean all kinds of things, like that, you know, my child isn't measuring up or my child should be able to do this, but they're not. But in reality, a lot of these kids are behind on some of those key skills. And it doesn't mean they're not going to get there, but we, and I keep bringing it back to me, can definitely get stuck in kind of comparison mode when I see what other kids are doing, or I look on my Facebook newsfeed and I see what, you know, what my peers' kids are doing at certain ages. And I recognize that there's a gap there in terms of timeline of where my child is versus where some same age peers might be.
And I didn't expect to go here, but I think it's just really relevant in this conversation and will be helpful to parents, because you've just spoken to so many parents and so many experts about these types of things. But when your child is lagging in an area, then what tends to happen in traditional schools, even in what we would consider a non-traditional school, I want to say this, parents, I haven't said this on any other talks, but a lot of schools that we consider non-traditional today are still totally driven by traditional processes. So when these kids are in these traditional schools, what we tend to do is focus on deficits, not see the strengths or the interests or the passions or the gifts or the talents. So how do you want to respond to that briefly, since you've seen so many people? Because I think a lot of people do, they're comparing, but there's a big picture to look at.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, there's so many things to talk about there, but I think that just that strengths versus deficits is a huge shift, a huge tilt that we can make in how we perceive our kids. Again, when we're getting feedback from schools, which I used to get a lot of, one of the reasons why we switched and homeschooled for so many years, but when you're getting feedback that your child is not thriving, is doing things wrong, is behind, you know, all of those things, all that is deficit based
focus.
Thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we're doing. We're working on the problems. We're working on, you know, behavioral management plans to focus on all of these things that they're not doing well. And we don't celebrate the incredible gifts. And, you know, we know that the gifts are where these kids are going to find their success. That's their sweet spot. And so we do them a huge disservice by spending so much time focusing on deficits. And so that's something that we have to, as parents, be aware of and really look, first of all, notice our own language and the way we ourselves are talking about our children or introducing our kids to caregivers or babysitters or new teachers or whatever. We often lead with their deficits because we are concerned about our kids being judged or, you know, whatever. So we want to kind of, or that we're going to be judged for not being good parents. So we might lead with their deficit, so they know that we know what's going on, but there's a reason for it, instead of focusing on their strengths. So we need to start with ourselves in the way that we talk about our children and introduce them to the world and advocate for them, so that we can then work with schools or whoever to make sure that that kid is spending most of their time in their area of strength.
Yeah, which is, even if we try, is not necessarily going to happen in the traditional classroom. So as adults, we can do our part to really foster these things. And I want to mention at this part in the conversation, for parents who are not super familiar with these sort of ideas too, is that a lot of times the strengths of differently wired kids or the gifts or the talents of differently wired kids are right in your face, but we don't see them as or give them as much gravity or weight because they're not things that are traditionally measured. So a lot of times the filters that we've been trained to see in culture through all these years are the things that are measured: math, science, social studies, reading, writing, what have you. And if your child has gifts and you're seeing, oh, my kid with Legos or drawing or communication or telling jokes, you know, you might not think of that as a gift, but that might be you really want to sort of, I think, look outside the traditional box that we often see and really look at what's right in front of you. What are your kids' gifts? 2 seconds. Tell me. Mm-hmm. You probably know intuitively and you probably say it all the time. But so I'm saying that because I like Debbie, I think it's so important that we build upon these and foster these, because these are the things that our kids are going to be able to build a future on, build a career on, and develop throughout their life. And we have an opportunity to do it outside of school or more creatively.
Yeah. And let me just add to that. And again, this is a whole other conversation, but I will just say that part of this work is for parents to really kind of get real about their own expectations of who their child is and will be in the future, because that's where all the problems happen. So it's hard to look at your child's strengths creatively and with that open mind if your vision of success looks a certain way, and that's, you know, success only looks like my child going to, you know, a four-year school and doing this kind of thing, or going to this private school, or whatever it is. So I think that that work has to happen first to be able to really recognize and appreciate where your child's gifts lie.
So how does a parent who is not even aware of this stuff, because we have been, quote, programmed, and I'm not saying like somebody's out there like pulling the strings necessarily, but we have grown up in a culture that has certain values and we don't question it. For example, I love to use the example of letter grades. I personally believe letter grades are morally wrong and they are ineffective at doing the job that we think they are doing. Now, I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole, but that's one thing that people don't even question. I didn't even question as a teacher for years. Mm-hmm. Then I really started being like, this does not feel right. Mm-hmm. And then I really had to really, and it took me months to start checking in with myself and being like, and then started questioning it. And why do we have these? And then I start going down the rabbit hole and then I start making my own decisions. But how does a parent who doesn't even know what the DKDK, we don't know what we don't know. We don't know what we're not conscious of. We don't know how influential our upbringing has been and our culture has been and what we think. Because I think for you and I and all adults, a lot of our growing up into adults is unlearning and finding what is my truth? What is Seth's truth? What is Debbie's truth? And then for those of you watching, you're saying, you know, we've gone through, my parents taught me this, but I don't agree. You know, we all are all searching. So how does a parent sort of start to go down that rabbit hole of even knowing what they don't know? That was a big question, huh?
No, it's a good question. And actually the first tilt in my book is to question everything you thought you knew about parenting. Because I think that that's where you have to start. And it takes time. It might take journaling. It might take long conversations with a friend. But it is everything. I think everything has to be up for debate.
Awesome.
And, you know, I'm a big fan of the word why. I'm a certified life coach. And when I went through training, we learned this. It was like the five whys. And you basically, anything that you want, like, you know, here's a little example. Like when my son was in second grade, he had to keep a reading log. Well, my kid reads like 50 books a week. And the reading log was tedium that annoyed the hell out of him. And so I was like, well, why does he need to keep this, you know, this log? So I had to question, is this log really matter? No, not really. So why is he doing it? Well, because his teacher, you know, requires it. Well, why does that matter? Why shouldn't I, you know, so you can kind of keep pushing to, you can ask five whys to any assumption and get to what's at the core of it. And so with that example, I ultimately just told the teacher, I'm like, so Asher will not be filling out any more reading logs. It's a waste of his time and it's counterproductive. And I'm just letting you know that's what's happening. So if my second grader is going to get doctor grade, it's going to be okay. So I think everything has to be up for debate. Our parenting philosophies, our ideas about our kids' education, everything. And it just takes a constant, you know, it takes a lot of reflection, and that looks different for everybody, but it starts with the intention to do that work.
Such an awesome tool, such an easy tool. Why? Yeah. To really get us questioning things. And I think that's a thank you for saying that. That's an awesome, awesome place to start. All right. So let's start taking this into the meat of the session. Although this has been such a fantastic foundation for it. So when you are looking at parents, Debbie, and they have a kid who's struggling with executive function, and they're starting at point A, and then they have many tilts, or they have transformations, and they completely are able to change their experience, and things feel just a lot better. How do you describe the change for parents, or what do you see over and over and over with parents when they're at point A? And then they've learned all the stuff, they've done a lot of work and everything, and they're finally at point B, which is Okay, we're in a better place now.
I think point A is that is really rooted in fear. So point A is maybe when we've just gotten a diagnosis for our child, or we're getting that feedback from the school, like we're understanding, okay, this is not the path I thought we were on, and all the tools in my toolbox don't seem to be working. The books my friends are reading aren't really applying to my situation. No one seems to get what's going on. And so point A is that moment of, that moment can last for years. It can be this, you know, stuck in fear, fix it mode, desperation of trying to get back on the path that we wanted to be on in the first place, whatever that looks like. It might look like, you know, lots of therapies. It might look like jumping around to multiple schools. It might look like denial. It might look like all kinds of things. Point B, where we want to get to, is coming to a place of acceptance of who our child is. And acceptance doesn't mean that, you know, we just are in this state of blissful zen about, and that everything's fine. It just means that we accept who our child is as their own unique being on their own journey. We don't feel enmeshed with them, that they are a reflection of us, that we really respect who they are, and we recognize our roles to support them in being the best person that they can be. And we do that from a place of confidence and peace, and we're not in that fear space anymore. We're in a space of possibility, which feels so much better.
And, you know, I notice it, like, even in my practice, I get a lot of parents. So when I'm working with a family, it's an interesting dynamic because I work with the parents and the student, and they're in two different places. And a lot of times the student's like, oh, my parents need to get off my back. And the parents are like, but my kidney, you know. So the parents that come to me, oftentimes the timeline lagging, which is, I think, another way of saying what you just said again, but that they're thinking, my kid's supposed to be in these places, and I'm afraid that they're not, and things aren't going to be okay. And then they come to a place of acceptance where, you know what, my kid is right where they're supposed to be. How do I help them from right where they are to have a good life? But I notice in my work that I can just feel it from certain parents who have that really, you know, my kid's got to go to this type of college, or my kid's got to get these type of grades, or has got to have these types of behaviors. It's so deeply ingrained. Mm-hmm. So for the parent that says, I don't have any fears, and, or who doesn't really identify with fear, the word fear, because I think that even that's a scary word, to sort of normalize that. And how do they, I know there's the why, but how do they sort of, I guess, how do you push that button to say, hey, parents, you don't want to look at this, but it's okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
No,
I think
for the ones that have such a wall up.
Yeah. I think you need to start with where the conflict lies. So if you're watching the summit, or you're following Seth's work, or you're following my work, or any of the work of the experts in TIFOS, then you have conflict around some aspects of your life with your child. The conflict might be over, they're not getting the grades you think they should get. They don't seem to be thriving in school. They're not listening to you. Their behavior is out of control, whatever that is.
Do you mean more of an internal conflict where you're disturbed?
It could be both.
Okay.
It could be real conflict, you know, that's happening in real time between you and your child, or it could be like, I guess I'm talking
about
the pain that you're experiencing, you know, whether that's stress or anger or frustration, whatever that is. And all of that is where, in that space where the conflict is where all the information is. Because all of that conflict or anxiety, stress, frustration, pain, whatever it is stemming from the fact that reality is not meeting our expectations. That's it. So the only thing that we need to do, and I say it like the only thing, like
it's simple, but yeah.
It's not. But whenever we notice that we're having that kind of reaction, frustration that our child is like getting up and doing laps around the dinner table. That's something to examine. Like anytime we feel that, you know, getting out of the door on time, you know, getting into the car on time is like, why is this happening? You know, that's a source of conflict. Anytime we feel that, it is because what's happening isn't matching what we think should be happening. And we need to reconcile those in order to move on. And that's, so it doesn't have to be just fear, but that is where all of this happens. And it comes with us noticing, okay, this is what's going on. And this is actually what's really going on. So we have to kind of keep kind of digging.
It's hard because we have to interrupt the pattern, and the patterns are just these responses. We respond to the situation. And a lot of times we just, our response is, let's just push harder, or let's just rationalize with our kids and logic them and communicate to them and say, if you would just understand, blah, 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 everything would be so much easier, whatever the defaults are. And we have to interrupt the defaults and have a little gap and say, whoa, okay, something feels off. That's a signal that this is an area to explore.
And it might not happen in the moment too. Just like, it's not like, like I'm still not great at like catching myself in the moment. Often it'll be later on after I've had a conflict with my child that I'll be like, okay, that was totally my issue about this. And then I'll work on it and set an intention to be more aware next time.
So you started homeschooling, and you've learned a lot about homeschooling and education and how to work with a student who's struggling with executive function in various ways. So what are some of the, the things that hold people back when they're trying to help a kid who struggles with executive function in the homeschooling world? So what are some of the blocks that families
experience? Yeah. I mean, I think first of all, homeschooling alone is, homeschooling, making the decision to homeschool a differently wired child is stressful. Like most of us, I've never met a parent that said, yeah, I could not wait. We made the decision and I knew it was the right thing. Like that never happens. It's most people are like, I don't think I could do what you do. And I'm like, well, you figure it out. Like if you're in my situation, you figure it out. But I didn't want to do it. It took me a year and a half to decide to do it. So I think there's a lot of fear initially that we can't handle it. That, you know, if we know our child is not thriving in school, what is that going to look like at home? How is that going to hurt our relationship? How will anything ever get done? You know, so we have kind of those bigger fears initially or concerns that prevent a lot of families from even considering it because it just seems too difficult. Once you start doing it, you know, there's so many layers to this, but you know, I think one of the first things is that we have expectations about what our homeschool is going to look like. And it often never turns out looking the way we thought it was going to look. And so that is where conflict happens initially upfront for a lot of people, is they feel this pressure that they have to do it a certain way, or they need this many hours a day, or they're going to fall behind, or their child shouldn't be on their computer as much as they are. Like it's just, it feels so stressful to have that responsibility of educating your child. And then there's no blueprint for how to do it with a child who thinks differently and learns differently. So that can be really overwhelming if we cling to, you know, this vision for, you know, if we think our kid's going to sit at the dining room table for, you know, 6 hours a day and do worksheets or whatever, that is not going to end well for most families. So that's kind of one of the initial things. I can share what we did in that situation. So I was that parent. I had plans like nobody's business. Like I had, you know, goals for every class, and I had all the, you know, handpicked these cool curriculums and found projects, and I was on it. And it was not working out the way that I thought it was going to work. And then I would get upset with Asher because I was like, I'm taking all this time off. Like I'm basically putting my work on hold to teach you and you have this opportunity and you're not even appreciating it. You know, like it was messy. I didn't recognize that, A, he needed some time to detox from school to kind of, you know, he had some PTSD, I think, from what had happened in his three schools prior to his homeschooling, and needed some time to just, like, get out of fight or flight mode. But then beyond that, I also had to recognize that he and I needed to create our school together, that I couldn't be, you know, just dictating what was going to happen. If this was really going to work, and this is what I've seen happen, you know, be the case with most kids like this, is we have to consider ourselves co-creators of our school, and everything has to be designed together. We have to partner like we're a team, and also be willing to continue to evolve, you know, not just from year to year, but sometimes month to month.
So there's a sentiment in our culture that, well, I couldn't ask my kid like how they would want to create school or design curriculum or design school or pick what they're learning, because mm-hmm. we can't trust kids to do that. How would you respond to that? And I'm just saying that's something that I think is steeped in our culture. That I don't see that in my work, because I've been doing this a long time and I differently, and it's so easy for me to see that. But for the, I know that that's something that a lot of parents might be thinking right now. Well, how would I do that?
We know that kids, and this is one of the things in one of my favorite books, The Self-Driven Child, they talk a lot about that kids want to feel a sense of control. It doesn't matter how old they are, how young they are. And so when you even start, I mean, what kid at, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 is being asked their opinion on what they'd like to do, or how would you structure your day? That feels incredible to a child to realize that their ideas have value, and that we care, and that we're going to work together. So in my experience, you know, these kids, and personally, Asher would create much more demanding schedules for himself than I ever would have. Mm-hmm. You know, the more power I gave him, the more flexibility, the more open I was to his ideas, the more creative his ideas became, the more, even with regards to screen time, you know, I'd find he was even tougher on himself in terms of what he thought the rules should be, in terms of his access to screen. So I think that that's selling kids short. They really, kids want to be happy. Kids want to do well. They want to feel a sense of success and value and worth, and they want to feel respected. So when you meet them halfway, they will totally rise to meet our expectations.
There's so many. I mean, we could talk for hours, because there are so many paths I could go down on this. One little practical thing I want to mention here is the why fits so well into this too, because one educator that was really, really, really influential on me, she would be working with a kid, and the kid would have a request, and she would ask about it a little bit. So you might do the why. Hey, mom, can I do this with school? Why? You know, can I just play video games all day? Why? Like, you can actually listen to what they're thinking. Yeah. But one of the things that she would do is she would filter it, and she would go, I don't see why not. But what that taught me is that she really was listening to what they did. And then whereas a lot of teachers and parents we've grown up with, do as I say, not as I do, do what you're told, you know, rather than stopping to think, actually, that makes sense. Or I can take part of that. I can work with this. But, you know, as a parent, you get to have your boundaries. You don't have to accept everything that they say. That's not what we're saying here. But you can really help unpack it with them and give them ownership and buy-in, which we don't often do. But if you're just shifting to that, it's not going to happen right away. It's a learning on both for the parent and the child in terms of how to navigate that.
Yeah, and I would say I'm a big fan of Dr. Ross Green's collaborative and proactive solutions model. And so I kind of borrow some of that too when we're designing our school day or, you know, our plan. Is I'm always flexible and I'm always open to trying new things. And I'll often say, like, if he's proposing to do something or create a schedule that feels really alternative to me, like, what if I did all my personal screen time in the morning or whatever? I would say, okay, I'm willing to try that. How long should we try that? And then we're going to check back in. So often we'd say, okay, let's try it for 5 days. And then we'll, and I have to be willing to just go all in and try it. And then we meet back. Oh, and then we reflect. Do you think that's working? Do we need to tweak it? And so that's why it's a constant negotiation. And what works really well for a week or a month might all of a sudden stop working, but you're homeschooling. And that's the joy of it. You can throw, there are no rules. And I would even have to tell Asher that even in our last year of homeschooling, after doing it for 6 years, I'd still say, dude, this is our school. We can do whatever we want. Like, we don't have to stick to anything. And that is really freeing and exciting for kids.
And I think it can be really scary for a parent to let go of the reins and say, we're going to try this for 5 days. And also, it's a lot of work to manage that for 5 days and remember the negotiations you made and hold your boundaries and even remember what they are, and to watch it unfold and to watch it not work. But in the long run, it is way less energy and way more empowering. But it's so sometimes scary to let go of those reins and know that things will be okay.
Well, it also, to speak to another challenge that a lot of us experience or that we're concerned about, is that it's going to damage our relationship with our child. So when we're holding on to the reins and we're attached to the outcome and we're stressing, that's when we become nags. That's when we kind of micromanage. And that's when we really hurt potentially our relationship with our child and create a lot of unnecessary conflict. But when we do it this way and we really are in a collaborative mindset and we're flexible and open-minded, like we all want our kids to have growth mindsets, but a lot of us don't as parents. But you know, if we can stay in that space, it also takes the emotion out. It's just data, right? We're experimenting and we don't have to be emotionally attached to the outcome or make what happens with our child mean something about us as parents. And so it really can reduce the conflict and preserve our relationship with our child much more than if we try to, you know, be an authoritarian teacher. Mm-hmm.
So as far as the executive function stuff is concerned, then, so you've got a kiddo, you want to, educate them, right? You're homeschooling them. Why? Because you want to educate them. Mm-hmm. And what constitutes good education or the type of education that we need to be able to have a good life is definitely debatable, definitely changes from person to person, but we are in a culture or paradigm that says that you don't need to think about it. We will give you a thing called a curriculum purchased by the experts that will, it's hard to sort of trust our gut and find out what to do. The point is we're trying to figure out what are the bricks that need to be put in place to launch this kit. And in order for them to launch and be able to do what they want to do in their future, they do have to have the executive function things. They have to be able to plan. They have to be able to organize. They have to be able to manage time, prioritize, all of these things. So, and as a homeschool parent, what are some of the things that you do or keep in your head or work with to help develop these things so that they're not gaming 24/7 or whatever, but they're actually doing some meaningful things and executing on them and following through? How do you know what's complete? You know, is it doing all 20 problems on a worksheet? Do not use worksheets. That's a huge problem. And I'm going to shut up and let you know where I'm going with this. How do we build executive function into homeschooling?
Well, I have so many things that I could share. So I'm going to just share a couple and then we can keep going or you can ask questions or whatever. One of the things that I focused on first, and it depends on your child's age, was even, again, that co-creating the school together. And so much time went into planning out our week. Like, what does our week look like? And helping Asher kind of think ahead. So one of the things I would do, I don't know if I printed that out.
I'm going to repeat something you just said. You said so much time went into planning X. So we are so focused on, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're so focused on covering curriculum in our culture, but you're actually doing something that is teaching. Mm-hmm. You spent I'm imagining when you say so much time, you really mean that in and of itself was a massive project, and that's okay.
Yes. Especially when I was teaching in math, but that's a whole other story. Thank God my husband took that over. So every year it would look different, and I would ask Asher how he wanted to structure his week. And I have a prop. I'm just going to show you what our last year of homeschooling looked like. This is what Asher, he wanted more. He was in middle school and he wanted more of a traditional schedule. This was his choice, where he wanted each day to be different with electives. So you can see these are the classes he had, like personal project. This was an online class, rhetoric and debate. This was another online class, marine bio. We were reading social studies together. PE, we would just go for a walk in the park, whatever. But anyway, but I put this on Velcro so that even with this, like, he didn't want it set in stone. And so we had this, but I gave him, you know, we'd start the week and we'd be like, okay, is this how we want the week to unfold? Or, I'd give him the chance to move things around. And I still wasn't attached to this. Like, the days did not unfold like this perfectly, but this was a good way for him to start looking at the week as a whole. And I also would make, I think I'd write it on a whiteboard. I would have, what are the big picture goals of the week? Let's take a big look at the week. So we would go subject by subject and say, okay, in marine biology, which was an online class he took that he loved, he knew he had a homework assignment. So that was the big goal for the week. Turn in the homework assignment for marine biology. If it was social studies, maybe it was like read 3 chapters of this book. So we would look at the goals for the week. And then every morning in our morning meeting, which it's really important to have a morning meeting, we would go through, okay, where are we on this goal? And then what do we need to do to get closer to that goal? And I did, I have all kinds of handouts, which I'm making
available. Let's hold off on that one for a second.
Okay. Sorry. I'm getting too excited.
It's so good. It's so good. So all of these things that Debbie is talking about are executive function. And when you say how you would plan the week and then do your morning meeting, how much time do you think you spent when you planned the week and then when you did the morning meeting?
When I personally planned the week?
With him.
Yeah. Our Monday morning meeting would be probably like 45 minutes or something. Okay. And that's when we would also look at what else is happening this week. What day do you have piano lessons, or what day do you have a play date with this friend or something?
One of the hard things about my job is I'm working with all these different adolescents. And I spend so much time with them on planning in the office before we even get to the homework. Mm-hmm. It's so important. So what Debbie's saying is 45 minutes on the Monday and then each day doing a morning meeting. This is planning, people. This is executive function. But she has the buy-in and the ownership. He has choice. Mm-hmm. He's participating in the process. And she said she's not attached to the outcome. That's very important, because just because we make a plan does not mean we need to keep to it. We can recalibrate. We should recalibrate. We do recalibrate, but they're making it. So what Asher's getting to do is he's getting an opportunity to have experience after experience after experience of planning. Debbie doesn't have to worry about, did it work? Did we execute the plan perfectly? It's not about necessarily, ironically, the execution of the plan. It's about the experience of the plan. I'm going to say that again. It's not necessarily about the execution of the plan. It's about the experience that Asher had planning. That is education. That is learning. That is executive function. And when they planned, when they did this, he's also practicing other aspects of executive function. He's organizing the chart. He's keeping flexibility because he wants it to be able to be to change. He's obviously working on managing time. He's also prioritizing, and he can change his priorities on different weeks and when he does certain things to an extent. I'm sure, like math, I know is more rigid because your husband was teaching math on a different schedule, so there are going to be limitations to the schedules in some ways, you know, if there's an online class that has specific live sessions or this or that, but there's flexibility. Anyhow, the point is you don't have to memorize everything Debbie's saying, but what she has used strategies that do buy-in and ownership and that allow him to practice all these skills. And she's not worried about, is every single thing done to cover the curriculum.
Yeah, no, not at all. And in fact, as he got older, he became more curious about when he was more in the right frame of mind to tackle a subject that required more focus in writing or whatever. And that's what we want, you know, we want them to understand themselves. We want
from
them
in here. Yeah.
Yeah.
From them.
You know, like, oh gosh, morning is actually my most productive time. So I should put these things there. So they're out of the way and they're getting my best brain power. So that's something that over time he started to become more aware of. And of course we talk a lot of what I do with him is talk about this stuff and have him reflect afterwards and just always ask him questions like, how did that feel? And was that really hard for you to do today? I noticed it really seemed to take you a while to get this done, or you seem really distracted. You know, so a lot of what I do with him is to help him try to uncover his own flow, his own process, so that he can have a deeper understanding of himself.
So I take it you don't tell him what he should do a lot of the time.
No, I don't.
You're asking questions and...
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I would say, would you like my advice or would you like to know what works for me? But as much as possible, I try not to tell him what to do because that never works well.
But that's what we do as... Yeah. As schools and parents is, oh, you should do it this way. Oh, you should try that. Oh, yeah. It'd be better if you did this. And as you're communicating, I can just hear you saying, you know, we're reflecting. How did this go for you? Blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. You're not saying, did you notice? Blah, blah. I mean, you may in the conversation, but the way you're framing it, I can tell that you're someone who's really more, you just want him to think. Again, you're not, just like with what I said about the planning, you're not worrying about executing the plan perfectly. Here, you're not worried about him having the right answer or the best answer.
No.
You're worried about him reflecting. You're developing the skill of reflection, mm-hmm. of introspection, mm-hmm. of awareness, mm-hmm. self-awareness. Of...
Yeah.
I'm sorry to get so excited too, but to interrupt so much, but I just want to point out some of the subtlety behind what Debbie's doing and why it's so important with executive function, but in general.
Yeah. So I'm going to share with you another thing that I would use. So I always made sure that we had a big, there was always one or two bigger projects. You know, often I, whenever possible, I would use his interests to do all of this stuff. So it's because I always felt that this was as important, if not more important than the learning stuff, you know, than the academic content. And he's someone who tends to learn pretty easily. So I would just focus on his areas of interest and use those as the springboards for everything. So so one of the things we have spent a lot of time on, and I'll share these with people too, is figuring out how to break down goals. I always made sure he had at least one big project he was working on. And, you know, I had this little goal planning worksheet that we would go through where he would have to write down the goal, the deadline, how will he know when he's completed the goal, how will he feel after he's reached the goal, and then what kind of the little steps are. And so every day in our morning meeting, we would go through this too. Any goals we were working on, where are we with this? What do you think you can tackle any of this today? What are you thinking? And I also would always have this up on the wall. So I will, whatever the goal is by what date, I'll know I've completed it. And then always ask him what his personal why is. So I would always try to take it deeper than just execution, but what can he learn from himself about this experience? And I use these for a couple years, and it's been really fascinating to see, because he is someone with a lot of projects, like almost more than I have at any given time. And he's really, he has a whiteboard and he knows how to kind of break things down now into the things that he wants to do. So this works, but it just takes a lot of time and curiosity and just continuing to go back and check in every day on these things, you know?
Again, what you've done is you've taught a skill of breaking things down.
Yeah.
And of introspection and reflection and all of these executive function things.
Yep.
And it's so, I just really like listening to this because it's so driven by him and it's so letting things unfold rather than us pushing and again, covering curriculum and checking all the boxes. And
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't say I didn't care about the academic stuff, but I really felt, I know that this is the most important factor. The not being able to do this stuff is the only thing that's really going to get in his way as an adult.
Explain that for us.
Well, I just, you know, I think you can learn academically. Maybe you can test well, or you can like learn how to do a math project, you know, whatever it is you want to learn. But being able to have something you want to do and know how to get there, that's everything, you know? Otherwise, you're just going to stay stuck with ideas that you can't ever realize. And that is a recipe for depression and just not thriving and not being able to contribute your gifts. So I've always felt that this stuff was more important than anything else I could share with him. I really felt like that was my primary job as his teacher, was to teach him this stuff.
Is that going to be in the implementation resource?
You mean all these worksheets? Yes.
Cool. Yeah. Okay. Yes. So what else you got?
So, I wanted to share something that we did for several years, which was really great. And for emotional regulation, and that was, we used to do something called the Miracle Morning. Are you familiar with that? So we did that for 2 years. The Miracle Morning is it's a book and an approach created by this guy named Hal Elrod. And it basically was about starting off your day with these six things that you would do. You know, you would set an intention, you would visualize, you would do a little bit of exercise, you would do some reading, you would do a little journaling, and the last one might have been meditating.
I don't remember.
We haven't done it for a little while.
Essentially, they did a bunch of research, and they found out that these are the best things that the happiest people or the most productive people do, or something like, yeah.
Yeah, and so I really, you know, I'm a runner, as I said earlier, and I have a lot of self-care tools, and I also recognize how important that is for being emotionally healthy person and knowing how to take care of yourself. So we read this book together and we committed to trying it for a month in the new year when he was maybe like 11. And we stuck with it for over a year, probably more than a year and a half. And it evolved over time. Like our visualization was like listening to, you know, music, like Badly Drawn Boy while laying in my bed and just kind of zoning out for 5 minutes. But it was really awesome. It really helped him start recognizing that he could be intentional about creating what he wanted in that day. And that was, out of all the six things, the visualization piece was the one that he liked the most. Because, you know, just imagining himself kind of achieving what it was that he wanted to do. So that was we still incorporate little bits and pieces of it here and there. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, it's an executive functioning skills in other ways. But I think it teaches that kind of emotional regulation piece that can really help start your day off the right way. So that's something that I'm a fan of.
Mm-hmm. You're a fan of the visualization or the morning routine?
Yeah, just any kind of morning routine that you can create. And again, like create it with your child. You know, Astra and I still often go for walks together in the morning. And that's just something we agree to do. And that's how we start our day. And we always have better days when we do that. And he knows that too.
I like that you connected the dot that's helped him have more agency or more internal locus of control, or more like he understands that he gets to create his day or his life, or instead of, again, being told like we do so often. So cool.
One of the, I have a couple other little tips.
Great.
Would you like me to share?
Yes.
Okay. Absolutely. So one of the things that this is just a little thing, but if you're using online curriculums. There are so many amazing classes that are available. And I used to get stressed out about the deliverables for those classes because execution and producing things is really difficult in our house. And so I questioned everything. And I realized that I could just email the teacher and say that, oh, actually, Asher is just going to be auditing this class. And, you know, I would do that maybe a couple of weeks. And when I realized that, you know, that the stress surrounding turning certain things in was not worth it. What was worth it was for him to learn this information and that we could slow things down. And it was always, you know, you talk about this a lot, Seth, like zooming out and keeping your eye on the big picture. And that's what you have to do when you're homeschooling constantly. Was it so important that he, you know, he did a Shakespeare and pop culture class this past year. And he loved the class because he liked learning about how Shakespeare had been translated in different mediums. But there were these deliverables each week that were creating so much stress and anxiety. And part of me was like, well, he needs to learn how to kind of follow through and do stuff. But then I was like, but what's the big picture here, you know? And so I let him kind of do the ones that he was interested in and the ones he wasn't. I was like, don't worry about it. Just kind of read the play and we'll discuss it. And maybe we'll watch some extra movies about this, you know, Hamlet or whatever. And so I think that you just recognize that you have a lot of flexibility, even within a curriculum, even if you're doing official online classes, you can make the rules and be in charge of what's actually happening.
Yeah. And to speak to homeschool parents specifically about that as well, because I work with homeschool parents quite a bit. And when I'm helping them design things, one of my favorite frameworks is the content process product. Are you familiar with that? So essentially, when we're learning something, we have content, what we're learning, process, how we learn it, and the product, how we show our learning. And as a teacher, after I got skeptical about grades and started changing it, you know, what we're trained is that you do what I say. So you do this worksheet, you finish all 20, you get an A, or you get 100% or whatever it is. You get extra credit. You get 5 extra percent. What the heck is extra credit? It's because I said that that extra one is worth more. It doesn't mean anything except the meaning we gave to it, and like to question those things. But content process product is really cool. The content, one thing that you've said a lot is that there's a lot of ownership. You base it on his interests. You drive the content by his interests. Now, does that mean that you don't have to learn how to write well, how to read well, how to do math well, and what kind of math? That math is a great one to talk about. But like, there are certain base things that we need. But a lot of the curriculum is driven by interests. The process, how are you going to learn it? There's so many ways. It's not just take a textbook, read it, listen to the lecture, and that's how you learn. But that's what our culture usually is. And then there's product. Now, product is usually a test or an essay in our culture, right? But there's so many ways to show your learning. So I play guitar. Nobody cares, but I've learned how to play. And I don't, my product is a song or is playing with a band or is playing on the couch, you know, and create, or, you know, it's, the product could be so many things. You know, it could be a video, it could be speaking it through. Like if a kid can communicate that they've learned the thing, they've learned the thing. They don't have to be able to write an essay on it. We have to really think about, and one of the areas that, well, I'm not going to get off on that tangent. Content process product parents. It really fits well into this, that you can design things based on interest and think about how do you want to show the product.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what are we measuring? And but when I could have a kid who wrote one page and a kid who wrote 20 pages and both of them get an A in the exact same class. How? Because what I chose to measure as a teacher is effort, learning. And I really judge myself as the teacher more than the kid's effort. If they're not engaged, that's my fault. Mm. What can I as a teacher do differently? And we can look at that as parents too. Not, oh, they're not trying hard enough. Well, what about us? How are we as homeschool teachers making it engaging? What can we do differently? And then ask them, get the ownership. Sorry to get off tangent. I don't feel like I'm getting off. I just feel like we could talk for hours and I only have 10 hours today for you.
I have two other things that I wanted to share. And then if there's more you want to ask about, I'm happy to share more. But
Go for it.
Okay. So one of the things that can be especially stressful, again, is, well, what happens if my child just decides to boycott school, right? And not get off their computer or whatever it is. That has happened to me a few times. And that's another situation where we want to avoid power struggles as much as possible. And so I'll include this in my little template thing, but I just had policies, and I would write, I'm big into writing things out, contracts, or having Asher and I sign things, our shared agreements about the culture of our homeschool and our respectful behavior and how we're going to respect each other. But the couple of times when there was just a lot of resistance to showing up to school and it wasn't happening, I would actually close, we had a room in our old apartment that was like the homeschool room, and I would close the door and I'd put a sign on the outside, and I would say that school begins at 10. If this door is closed, it's because you are late to school. We have several guidelines that we created together. And in order for school to resume, please answer the following questions thoughtfully and deliver this form to me. And so he had to write down, like, how is being late to school disrespectful? Do you think it's reasonable for your mom to wait an undetermined amount of time each morning while you continue to work on whatever you're doing? What could you do differently tomorrow? What restitution can you do today to make up for the late start today? So I would just leave this posted on the door. And I think I had some creepers from Minecraft on the original one. And that way it wasn't, and we may not have done school the entire day. Okay, we'll start again. We'll try again tomorrow. Like, I had to just, it was me making sure that I didn't add fuel to the fire. One day of law school, big whoop, it's not a big deal. The important thing is that he reflects on and thinks, like, okay, yeah, you're right, actually that was really disrespectful. And not that he got there right away, but this is what we want, right? We want our kids to start to recognize that their choices impact other people. They need to be responsible for their actions and how, and then think, okay, what would I do differently tomorrow? And if we can stay out of that emotionally and just be kind of even keeled, the learning can actually happen. And our kids aren't going to resist it. They're going to be more open to reflecting on those things. So that's one of my little hacks.
Awesome. I'd imagine that the emotional piece is hard to entire day or two and think, oh my gosh, we need to get back on track. And
it's really hard. And I will say there were many.
But you chose your battle and you said, I'm going to teach reflection.
Yeah.
And then I'm sure you had some anxiety around it, but what I want to point out is you didn't let it rule you. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times, you know, I may be concerned when I'm speaking with a student about certain issues, but I keep my cool and I'm still that calm person for them. And there are times too, when I'll say, you know what, that really doesn't feel good. That's really frustrating. I need to tell you, it's not like we just are even all the time, because that's not reality.
No, and I lost my cool. I lost my cool plenty of times, mm-hmm. just to be real. Like, I don't want people to think that I was like, never got upset. Got upset many times, but I also believe that that's where lots of learning happens. Like, I can model what it's like to make a mistake and how to ask, you know, how to apologize and how to work on my own coping mechanism and model that for my son. So I think there's learning in everything. Okay. So, and the last one that I wanted to share with you was about screen time policies and screens in general, because that's a huge issue, I think, especially when you're homeschooling, because our kids stay on computers a lot. I will just share that we do not have screen time limits in my house. We have guidelines. So I stopped with strict limits because it was creating so much stress in our family over me, you know, over the timers and then the battles to get off screen time. So we have guidelines that, you know, like there's no screen use after dinner and there's no screens before breakfast. Like, we kind of had these shared agreements that we made that seemed very reasonable to everybody. And then we would use something called the Pomodoro method, which I'm sure you're familiar with. But I taught this to Asher because I wanted him to start recognizing and understanding how long do certain tasks take me. So I created my own worksheet that he would fill out, where he would write down the things he wanted to do. Like maybe he's working on a special, he creates light maps for Minecraft, for example. And so I would say, well, how long do you think that will actually take you? If you want to do that before we do social studies, like, I'm okay with that, but I need to have a sense of how long will it take. And then he would have to estimate, you know, I think it's going to take me 45 minutes. I'm okay. I think Pomodoros are 25 minutes. So let's just estimate two of those time slots. And then when those time slots are up, are we done? So then he starts to learn more about how long things actually take, which is great information that we all could benefit from, just getting real about how long things actually do take. Because a lot of these kids think something takes 5 minutes and takes 3 hours.
Mm-hmm. Or the reverse, yeah.
Yeah. And so in doing this, it would help him kind of plan out what he wanted to do. He would prioritize what he wanted to do, because you always start with the most important task first, the MIT first, mm-hmm. and then, you know, what those other tasks are. And then with the Pomodoro technique, you are setting timers for like 25 minutes, and then you're pausing and reflecting and saying, okay, can I finish this, or do I need to pivot and move on to something else? So it helped him become more aware of things. And so we would do school and screen time kind of weaved into that. And that seemed to work really well. And I'm happy to share that with listeners or viewers as well.
Perfect. Awesome. And I love the same thing. What you do really well, Debbie, that I teach a lot and do a lot of my coaching, is you're concerned with the principle behind what you're doing more than with what you're doing. And the same thing I do a lot with, I do an NOP, number one priority, or MIT, most important thing, on my planning sheets. And I have kids predict how long things will take. And I'm focused, like you, on I don't care if they're right. Mm-hmm. I care. And I don't care to tell them, oh, do you think it should be longer or shorter? I mean, it depends on the situation. But generally speaking, I want them to predict it. And then the beeper to go off. I use digital timers a lot. And then to reflect with them and say, where were we? And then it's not, were you right or wrong? It's mm-hmm. just, I want them to connect the dots. Okay, I thought it would be this. It was actually this. And to learn calibration, it takes a long time, you know? Yeah. Yeah. But I do that. I do the MIT thing like you. I do the, I don't do Pomodoro, but I do having them estimate time and having them reflect on what that is. I have them prioritize their things on their list. So anyhow, so good.
So yeah, so I don't know if you have other specific questions, or I'm happy to talk about anything in more detail.
We're good. I'll start wrapping up right here. This has been so good. I know we could really go on for a long time, but let's wrap it up in this way. So you have a parent watching right now who is really concerned. They're homeschooling their kid. They're really concerned about executive function, their child being able to get to learn the skills that they need to get things done for their life. What's one thing that parents can do this week to implement something that you think is really important?
Gosh, I want to give you like a really concrete answer, but I also want to just, I mean, for me, so much of this work always comes back to us. And I would ask parents to recognize where their biggest area of stress is regarding their homeschooling relationship with their child, or the dynamic, or anything like that. Wherever that area of stress, conflict, anxiety, frustration is, to kind of write down what that is and then question whether or not it's really matters in the big picture. Is it you know, if it's a timeline thing, does it really matter that my child gets that right now? Will he or she be okay if they acquire this in a couple of years? Or, you know, whatever it is that's at the core of that, to question that and try to find evidence for how it might not be true. Because, I mean, I've got all these great hacks and I think they're really helpful, but the biggest thing that changed in my relationship with Asher when we were going through this, and the first year was pretty rough, I will be honest, was when I totally surrendered to the reality of what was happening with Asher, where he was, and let go of my expectations that he should be anywhere else. And that shifted everything. And that's when he started to relax. He stopped being in fight or flight mode. And our connection grew. And as our connection grew and he trusted me and he became more confident, then other things just start to become easier to learn and to develop. So it's not like a check it off, but it's the kind of thing that I think you have to start with that question.
Awesome. So good. And then I'm going to go on to my last, very last question. Before I do, is there anything key that you wanted to mention? Any models or words or anything that you want?
I would just say that if you're considering doing this, you can totally do it. Like I really, when my friend suggested that I homeschool Asher when he was, you know, I think the first time he was in first grade, and I just burst into tears. I was like, I cannot do this. It will ruin my relationship with my child. I will go insane. Like I was like, this, no way. And I hear that from a lot of people. So I would just say, if you're watching this and you are feeling that way, that you absolutely can do this. And just, if you're considering it, I would encourage you to go there and explore what it might look like. And I'm so grateful that I got to do this with Asher. We are so tight, and I love and feel so honored that I get to have this relationship with him and that I got to play that role for him.
And you are transitioning this year.
Yeah, he's going into ninth grade and he's going back to school after 6 years. So yeah, it's going to be interesting for both of us.
And I just want to point out, you know, that there's no contradiction in what Debbie's saying, because there was the buy-in in this process. Mm-hmm. They did this together.
Yeah, it was his. I just always said, we always would say, listen, we can, if this isn't working or we decide it's not working, we'll figure something else out. And this spring, I said that again. I said, we're back in the U.S. We could figure something out. If you feel like you need more, let me know. And we just kept discussing it. And so he's ready for something different.
And here's my very, very last question. And that is, from your heart to the heart of the parent who's watching right now, who's really concerned, what's the most important takeaway you hope people leave with right now?
Oh, just that your child is not broken. You know, I think our kids are so amazing. I believe that these kids have come into the world to heal, to problem solve, to shake things up and to disrupt in the best possible way. So if you have a differently wired kid, it's such an honor, I think, to be the ones to shepherd these kids, to share their gifts with the world. So don't think of them as broken. Think of them as uniquely gifted with incredible strengths. And it's going to be amazing to see how they impact the world.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Debbie Reber.
Thank you. Appreciate it. It was awesome.
All right, parents, go take some action. Have a great day. We'll see you in the next one.